Hello, podcast listeners. Fraser here. This is the second part of the interview that I did with John Michael Godier about all things, especially why I think we're alone in the universe. And John disagrees. All right. Enjoy this episode. And make sure you subscribe to the Event Horizon podcast with John Michael Godier.
Fraser Kane, welcome back to the program. Yeah. But there are a couple of candidates for captured interstellar objects that Jupiter somehow... Mm-hmm. wrangled in, and there are two of them I recall that are former comets that are just sitting out there ready for the sampling.
Ready.
And I'm hoping with what's happening, like we were talking about the Mars sample return mission basically getting canceled effectively. I'm hoping that maybe some private initiatives might come in, because that's starting to enter the table, private initiatives. But some of them are leaving the table, like SpaceX and Mars.
Oh, that was a nice segue. Yeah.
You like that? Okay. You like that?
Yeah.
That's why they pay me the little bucks, Fraser.
Yep. So you want to talk about Elon Musk, who has been just, his whole world and life has been focused around the human colonization of Mars. It was the very reason he started SpaceX. And if you actually go back to like the original foundation of SpaceX, he had been reading Bob Zubrin's Cases for Mars. Carl Sagan had been very inspired. In fact, he had, Jeff Bezos has, like all of these guys had been inspired by the Case for Mars. And he was like, yeah, we should be colonizing Mars. Like this is what science fiction has led us to believe. And Bob Zubrin made the case for Mars, that it was not only possible, but it was feasible at a relatively low cost, you know, just $5 billion, maybe $10 billion at the most, you could have a human mission to Mars that would return. And he was so enthusiastic about it that he wanted to, and he was already sort of a rich entrepreneur, and he wanted to send a greenhouse to Mars that then
green plants on Mars, the money.
Yeah. He would grow plants on Mars to demonstrate that, you know, the future of humanity is on Mars. And so he went to the Russians to pay for a flight to Mars, and they laughed at him. And so he said, well, I'm just going to build my own rocket company. And so he did. And that was SpaceX. And that he had kept SpaceX private, and the reason was always that he didn't want any investors to mess with the stated goal for SpaceX, which was to eventually begin the colonization of Mars, to send a city on Mars, that would be against shareholder interests. And the original development of the interplanetary transport, later called the BFG, the big freaking rocket, then turned into the SpaceX Starship, this fully reusable two-stage rocket, this was going to be required to send a city to Mars. And he was envisioning this day when there would be thousands of starships flying from Earth to Mars, setting up cities, sending colonists, building, providing supplies to build this future of humanity on Mars. And the reason that he did it, the reason he said, was because, you know, we don't want to keep all of our eggs in one basket. We want to spread life to the cosmos. And this is how you do this. And then about a month ago, not even during the Super Bowl, he sort of on a series of tweets said, actually, we've changed our mind, and now we're going to build a city on the moon first. And, you know, people had for a long time been saying that in fact, the moon makes a ton more sense. And if you're going to want to go and explore space, the moon is just a couple of days away, that you can rapidly iterate, solve problems, make mistakes, learn from those mistakes. And that if, you know, there's a medical emergency, you can bring the astronauts home. If they run out of supplies, you can send more. That it makes a ton more sense. And that once you're at the moon, the Lagrange points around the moon give you this really nice jumping off point to be able to explore the rest of the solar system. It really is a gateway. That we are so fortunate that we have the moon beside us, that it would be crazy for us to go to Mars when we should just be taking advantage of the moon. And so now, lurch... The SpaceX bus has turned 90 degrees and is now going to the moon instead of Mars. And this has obviously led a certain amount of the true believers to wonder what's going on. That is the charitable version of the explanation for what's going on.
I did not think that the Mars colonization plan was viable. I thought... you are going to get tourists that want to go there. There's always somebody that wants to climb Mount Everest. You know, they're that type of person, and those types of people will go.
Yes.
Probably going to want to come back. And there will even be people that are okay with it being a one-way trip. There are such people as well. However, a million people, you know, 25, I don't think that, I mean, I wouldn't go. You couldn't give me a ticket on that.
No, and I think in a previous episode, we...
Yeah, we did. Against
the human colonization of Mars and the potential of a future city on Mars. That I can... Absolutely ridiculous.
I can think of things we can do with the moon, though. You know,
so right, and so the justification, like the original justification that I think we had talked about last time, was that you know you put a research station on the moon, and in the same way that we have a research station on Antarctica, that makes sense, right? But there is this other thing that is starting to happen. And this was the justification that Elon Musk was giving. And that is that the rise of artificial intelligence is going to force companies to start launching their data centers and putting it in space. Mm-hmm. And that to supply the resources to launch these data centers in space, it makes the most sense to manufacture them on the moon and have a mass driver on the moon that is pumping AI training clusters into space
to I never thought I would see the viability of a mass driver on the moon, but it's here. We have it now. There's a reason to build it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah. And I think, you know, we had been in this time for there had been the longest time where there was no justifiable financial incentive to go to space. And people have come up with a million explanations for what you could do. You know, we need to go to Mars to put our eggs in another basket. Well, even if Earth had a horrible nuclear
war, the moon will work on that count.
It would still be better, right? Yeah. That, you know, if you're trying to avoid the robot apocalypse, well, the robots just chase you to Mars. Like they love to go to space. That you would do asteroid mining. Well, that's ridiculous. Like it's just way too expensive. That you would build collect solar energy in space and beam that back down to Earth. Again, ridiculous, too expensive. And you're heating up the Earth at a time when the Earth really should not be heated up some more. That there's just no reason to go to space. Now we're seeing the inkling of the reason with Starlinks. That satellite communication systems around Earth, that really is low Earth orbit, has always had a financially valuable reason for being, that in fact, it is more economical to launch a satellite to provide your internet communications than to build the cell towers that would blanket the same kind of area. One small satellite is more effective, more efficient, is a better business model. Now, like we don't need to talk about how astronomy is getting totally shafted by the rise of these satellite mega constellations. This is a tragedy on the highest order.
Well, that's
we'll shelve that for another conversation, right? How mad I.
Well, you can't impede progress, and these constellations allow internet access for basically anyone on the globe, and the uses for humanity outweigh. You know, I hate to take the contrarian view against astronomy on this, but the technological advancement of the species is going to trump astronomy. Yeah. We just have to rethink.
I don't care. I want dark skies. So,
well, that's true. And I will paint them black for you. Perfect. I will have Elon paint them black. Right. No, I understand the problem, but that problem was going to happen no matter what.
Yeah, I was joking with Pamela about this on Astronomy Cast, and we're like, well, what did you think that bold Star Trek future was going to look like, right? When you've got this star base floating around the Earth, and giant spacecraft are docking from these star bases around the Earth, they're going to be very bright. Like what do you think was going to happen, right? You want that Star Trek future? That's what it gets you. You look through the telescope, your eyes hurt, and you're like, astronomy now sucks.
The other thing is that, you know, if you look at the Star Trek future, the, you know, Starbase One or whatever they called that thing that was, you know, gigantic, you know, basically an artificial moon, you know, I mean,
in low Earth orbit,
Death Star level, you would see that thing like you wouldn't believe.
Night to day.
But the thing is that all of the support equipment that's needed for that, you would need thousands of shuttles flying around. I mean, you would have a constellation of shuttlecraft everywhere. You know, so it was going to happen no matter what. And I just can't justify, you know, like, well, look at what the possibilities of having internet available in, you know, places that are experiencing famine or war or something like that. That's more important to me.
Theoretically, having, like, I personally would be willing to give up the darkness of the night sky if we could provide internet access to the entire world in a way that was equitable. We're not there. Putting that in the hands of billionaires without government sort of helping to make this happen and enforcing it, right? Like, that's all it is that the billionaire says, I'm going to put up a satellite of constellations that's going to block the night sky. And the government says, fine, but you've got to make sure that everybody in our country has internet. And the billionaire goes, fine. And then the deal is made. But if it doesn't end up being with that level of equality, then you've got a problem. We gave up the night sky and a billionaire got richer and I'm mad about it.
Yeah, it would need to be a public access.
Yeah, and then I think that there is, you know, space is really big and that there could be a global coordination to limit the flight paths of the satellites so that they're, you know, if you're going to be over this part of the earth, you go in this very narrow corridor in this direction, like we have shipping lanes or flight lanes. Like, we can do this. It just is a coordination effort. And right now, horses have been let out of barns and companies are running wild, launching their constellations, countries even, and they're not coordinating in a way that they should. And so then you could do things like you could say the land over the skies above the big observatories like Vera Rubin are not to have satellites flying overhead. And so you're going to have worse. You could coordinate the orbits so that there's like no satellites flying above Vera Rubin. And so Vera Rubin always has a beautiful, pristine night sky. Like, these are the kinds of things that could be done if
especially when you're concentrating telescopes like that area of Chile, you know, mm-hmm. the Andes, they're all concentrated.
Yeah, you could put all the telescopes in Chile and then put all the rest of them in the Canary Islands or Hawaii. And fulfill the world's astronomy needs, and then you just make sure that satellites leave a wide berth in those two areas. And I think you could come up with compromises, but there are no compromises. Just everybody's running as fast as they can to create another tragedy of the comments. But again, I said, don't get me started, and you got me started.
I got you started, but
yeah,
I would advocate that we spend more money on Big Bang Neutrino observatories because they just pass right through the satellites. No problem. Right.
There you go. Yeah.
What I worry about, though, Fraser, is that with putting up this many satellites like this, what does a solar flare do to our internet eventually if we're so dependent on these constellations? That's scary stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, every one of these satellites is at risk. I mean, you've probably looked at these, was it the Miyake events?
Yes, of course.
Absolutely. Right?
That yeah, there are, it is Miyake events, yes.
Yeah, there are these six events that of solar storms that were so severe that they were burned into the rings of trees that yep. were around at that time.
Very
and
mysterious.
That the Carrington event didn't qualify.
No, it didn't. That was the amazing thing was Carrington, yeah. even though Carrington was so powerful that they couldn't turn off the telegraph system.
Yeah. It was lighting telegraph poles on fire.
Yes. And it didn't qualify.
Yeah. They were seeing auroras in the Caribbean.
And what's funny is like the Romans or whoever was around during one of these events, didn't notice. But they probably saw astounding auroras.
Yeah.
But other than that, they
didn't matter. Yeah.
They didn't matter.
Yeah. They didn't have telegraph poles to catch on fire. So we are deeply at risk to a solar flare. People always ask me, like, what is the space-based risk that I am most concerned about? And it is by far heads and shoulders above its solar flares. That,
well, I think the last time we talked, I told you I'd seen the great aurora, you know, of the Midwest. Actually, Mexico saw auroras, you know, about a year and a half ago?
Years.
And it drove it home. I'm like, man, this is dangerous because I have a power plant behind me, a substation right across the street. And that substation has the 60 cycle hum, never stops. It sounded like a didgeridoo during that aurora.
I heard it.
And wow. it was sitting in, and I asked a guy from Ameren, and I'm like, what was that? And he's like, it was bleeding off electricity. It was dumping it. So, and he's like, that's, we designed them because of solar, you know, problems so that they don't go offline, you know? And it literally, for some reason, and I can't really even think of a reason why it would, I don't have the technicals here, but it sounded like a didgeridoo. It was just sitting there cycling and, you know, And it was like, whoa. I don't know if I like living next to that thing, but, now what of, here's another scary one, Fraser. Let's talk about the scary stuff. Kessler syndrome with these mini constellations.
So like I've talked to a lot of people about the Kessler syndrome. And of course the sort of theoretical idea of this is that you have satellites crashing into other satellites and then they start to break up and then those satellites crash into more satellites. And eventually you've just got chunks of metal around the Earth. And then that makes it a lot more difficult to be able to ever launch. And it really looks like that is not the accurate depiction of it, that it's a more complicated story. So at low orbit, say where the International Space Station flies, where the Starlinks fly, these things are deorbiting and reentering the atmosphere within about 5 years. So even if they collided with each other and they turned into this giant sphere of shrieking metal, then 5 years later, it would all be gone and we clean as a whistle, right? Higher up, these things take longer. Things at, say, 1,000 kilometers can take a decade to deorbit. Things at 2,000 kilometers can take a century. So the higher up they go, but at the higher up you go, then the more space you have. And so there's less and less risk. So in fact, the better play is to put these satellites closer to Earth so that if you do run into any problem, they just deorbit themselves. And what we're going to be seeing, and even already, is that these Starlinks are just starting to deorbit nonstop. They are constantly re-entering the Earth's atmosphere and burning up. And so as we get more and more satellites, as we get 10,000, we're at 10,000, sorry, as we get to 30,000, as we get to 50,000, and if Musk is right, then we're going to see 1,000,000. Then this is going to cause a busier environment, a degradation of sort of the operations of satellites. Satellites are going to get hit more often, that you're going to have to expend more of your propellant moving your satellites around, that attempting to launch, you're going to have to take additional measures. But it's never going to get to this place where we are just shut off from the universe. So that's good news. But the bad news is that it is starting to look like the pollution, the metal pollution from aluminum burning up in the atmosphere of the different kinds of chemicals are going to impact the ozone layer and could cause other unintended effects. And it's not a lot. Like if we get to about 10 times as many satellites as we have today, the deorbiting of those satellites will cause serious consequences for the environment, for the atmosphere.
And it's the exact opposite in some cases. For example, aluminum. If you start throwing up aluminum oxides and, you know, things like that in the upper atmosphere, that will actually cool the planet.
Of these will cool the planet. Some of them will destroy the ozone layer. Some of them will heat the planet. So you're getting these kind of unpredictable effects based on what the satellites are made out of. None of them are good.
We need a giant laser that shoots them out
into the
solar system. And that way, once we have enough defunct solar powered satellites littering solar orbit, we've got ourselves a Dyson swarm at that point. We can claim it.
Well, I always say that we've already begun the Dyson sphere, that the first solar powered satellite was launched back in like the 1970s or something, 60s.
Yeah, I think it was late 60s, something like that.
That was the first solar powered satellite. And so now you were independently harvesting energy from the sun and the Dyson sphere had begun. And so now here we are, we have 10,000 satellites orbiting the Earth. We have we have 100 satellites that are in other places around the solar system. They are blocking radiation that would have gone out into deep space. This is how you get a Dyson sphere. Like, it's not going to happen overnight.
You do it progressively. And it's not a solid sphere. That's kind of a misnomer. It's a swarm, of energy collecting satellites. And even if they're not beaming it back to Earth or anything like that, they're just out there powering themselves with the sun. We've got it. We've done it.
Yeah,
which means, almost certainly means that aliens did it. So now my question is there a technosignature there for very extensive Dyson swarm dimming a star? And here we go back to Tabby Star.
Yeah, it wasn't a Tabby Star. Yeah. What I thought an explanation for Tabby Star was,
So it, which by the way, that's another Vera Rubin point, is more Tabby Stars, because it can see them, you know?
Yeah, there was one that we just reported on, where it looks like it was a brown dwarf that dimmed down to about 3% of its normal brightness for about 200 days. And it appears that it was caused by a giant ring system around the star.
Yeah, that's
caused by planets crashing into each other.
Yeah, do you remember that weird one early on where they spent months trying to figure it out, and it was an extensive, crazy extensive ring system.
Yeah,
that was causing the dips.
Yeah,
and but that's not Tabby Star. Tabby Star is not that.
It was a different kind of cloud caused by colliding planetesimals.
But it was just amazing to me that a ring system could be that extensive, because this just shames Saturn.
Yeah,
Saturn,
this one is half the distance from the sun to Mercury.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal. So Mars is now off the table for SpaceX.
It's been delayed. It's been delayed.
But not necessarily for governments, because you've got the U.S., which is sort of sputtering. And then you've got, you know, China. Eventually, Mars will be on the table for, you know, government-type exploration. However, we do have something cool coming regarding the moon. We're going to loop around it. Artemis 2, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh yeah, I'm so excited. Now it's possible that I'm, you know, because there's a Canadian on board, I'm a little
there is indeed, know, Canada going to the moon.
Yeah, but yeah. So it should have launched. It was originally going to launch in early February, and NASA was doing a wet dress rehearsal where they fill up the rocket, do the countdown, and then moments before the countdown, they stop, detank all of the propellant and reset. And so they're going through this process and they detected a hydrogen leak and they stopped the countdown like 5 minutes before it was, you know, they would hit zero. And then based on that, as well as some other issues they were having, they decided to push off the launch. And the problem with the Artemis launch is that you have to wait for the moon to return. And so you get your little window and then you have to wait 3 weeks for the window to come back around. And so they, in fact, like at the time that we're recording this, and I don't even know how this turned out, Artemis is doing another wet dress rehearsal to see if they've solved all the problems. And if that works, then they're going to be on track to launch it again in early March. And if all goes well, they're going to do this free return trajectory around the moon. So they'll launch to the moon and then they will sort of loop up over the top of the moon, and then they will fall back down to Earth in their Orion capsule and then re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And they'll get, when this happens, they'll be the farthest away the human beings have ever been, even than the Apollo missions, just because the orientation of the moon at the time during this flight. And they'll look out their window and they will see the moon close enough to touch. And yet they will then have to return home, and then we'll have to wait for the Artemis 3 mission to actually carry humans to the surface of the moon.
And if we don't do it, China will.
So, 2030, Chinese are on track.
And but the fact is that, here's a fun question for you. All right, so I have never seen a person launch to the moon. I was born just after Apollo ended. And now I get to see people actually launch to loop around the moon, at least. And the thing is that which rocket do you like better, Saturn V or the SLS? I have to say the SLS amazed me because it just leapt off that pad like crazy. Yes. And it was just like, whoa, that rocket got power, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, just the sheer audacity of doing this in 1969 makes the Saturn V with the lander and the capsule and the command module just so impressive, right? Now, here we are 50 years later with modern advanced technology, learned a few lessons about rockets, computers, trajectories, all of this. And still, the SLS with the Orion capsule can't match the performance of the Saturn V. Like, it cannot land humans on the moon and bring them back to Earth without a completely separate landing system provided by SpaceX. So no, my fondness is still on the Saturn V.
All right, Fraser, we have a news thing coming out that you probably aren't even aware of. And I hate to even mention it in a certain way. Donald Trump just announced disclosure on the UFOs, whatever that may be. Your Q&A sessions are going to be you are going to be working so hard for months.
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Did that just happen while we were recording?
Yeah. It just happened. I'm happy to take a look at what comes out. I'll just say
one way. Okay. So I'm just looking at the news now. It says that Obama shared classified information on the UFOs.
Yeah, but this is on, we actually have it up on the screen. Donald Trump's Truth Social, you know, his platform that he has, he basically said that he's ordered disclosure, essentially. Wow. So,
well, that will take attention off of whatever is going on in your country.
That's a good way to wag the dog.
Yeah. It's funny because if you watch, like, people are saying, oh yeah, Obama just casually announcing that he knows that aliens are real. But if you watch the interview, he doesn't say that.
No, he doesn't.
He believes it. Like, if
he believes it, but I thought I had to say, though, I'm like, well, what if he's just referencing the idea that he thinks there's alien life out there somewhere, which most of us do. So it was ambiguous.
Yeah, and that's and it turns out that's what he was saying.
But I will always look at whatever they have with great interest. I just don't know. Fraser, I have a hypothesis. The closer the alien is to you, the harder it is to prove it's an alien, which is why I'm a SETI person. Everybody's like, why don't you look at the UFOs? I'm like, because when you get one in your star system, in your atmosphere with you, it is orders of magnitude harder to prove that it actually is an alien.
No, you're so wrong.
No, I say that for a reason. Because number one, Adam Frank and and also Jason Wright both had papers on prior technological civilizations. How do you know it wasn't Earth life that went out to the Oort cloud, and their city got subducted or whatever, and we don't have any evidence. Although I do have a problem there, because if that did happen, they didn't use up the oil. But anyway, the second thing is that, if you get an advanced enough technology that can print out custom DNA and print out materials, how could you ever tell, especially if it was making it out of solar system, isotope material?
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Okay. So you're saying that if an advanced craft that has the flight performance of something that is impossible to humanity sets down on the White House lawn, that could be by a distant relation to humanity and not an actually completely separate alien civilization. You're going to have to prove a lot of stuff.
Whereas my burden of proof is, we see an alien radio signal from 100 light years away.
Right. Well,
I think you can safely say we're probably not related to that. You're going to have to look at
only 1,000 years. We could do that.
The other thing is that you have to look at the composition of that star system, because if it's a sun analog that formed in the same birth cluster as the sun, you can't actually claim it's an alien anymore because it may have been panspermic life.
I think you just need to keep an open mind, man, that you just need anything that provides sufficient evidence that it is not.
Well, there are, there's,
then it is.
Well, if the alien gets out on the White House lawn and it says, I want to talk to Fraser Cain.
Yeah.
And so you're talking to the alien. It's like, I'm an alien. Are you going to believe him?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say firstly, talking to a scientist. The
ray gun.
Yeah.
Because the very worst calamity, everybody always accuses me of wanting to find alien life so much that I'm trying to, special plead into it. No, the last thing I want to find is an alien in my atmosphere.
Yes.
Because that is the worst calamity that could ever befall humanity, because it immediately collapses all Fermi paradox solutions down to two hypotheses, whether you like it or not, whether they're evil, whatever, it all.
No.
We are in a zoo.
It's worse than that. It's worse than that,
yes.
Because that if we find evidence of life, the closer we find evidence of life, then the more likely it is that the great filter is ahead of us, that that whatever it is that has wiped out the life on all of those other worlds is now going to hit us. And the great filter is in front of us. So seeing aliens on Mars is the last thing that we want to find, because it means we're doomed to the great filter.
Yeah.
Right. Because then it means that life is everywhere, and yet we don't see any evidence of advanced civilization.
No, your automatic implication that you know, no one survives.
No one survives. Yeah. No, and so, survives. You know, we're people that would like to survive, please. So no, we don't get to survive.
Of course. Either. Of course. I want to have my head frozen, you know, by Alcor and wake up in 1,000 years and, yeah, you know, start my YouTube career back up. Yeah.
Join that future.
What is your thought about that? The cryogenics.
Like who doesn't want to live forever? So, right. As long as it works.
Me. I don't.
You don't want to live forever? I totally want to live forever. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, number one, statistically, I don't believe I could, because something will happen. I think Isaac Arthur actually calculated that you got about 10,000 years before you run out of time.
Right.
An accident will happen to you. Sure. Now,
we'll take 10,000 years.
That requires you to have digital backups of yourself, in which case I don't believe that would be me. So I'm gone at that point anyway.
Yep.
But I leave open the option that maybe I don't know everything. You know, maybe my agnostic self is wrong, and maybe there's something after this. If so, I want to find out. Not until it's time.
But are you willing to roll the dice to find out?
I am, yeah.
Really?
The thing is, I don't think I'm losing much, because if it just all goes black, what do I know?
You know, if you have no choice, then you might as well roll the dice. But I finally get
retirement.
That's not going to happen for any of us. If you are, you know, in the body of 22-year-old you forever, and you're having a wonderful time on planet Earth, you're probably not going to want to roll those dice to go like, I wonder if there's an afterlife. No, you're gonna enjoy and enjoy the future of the technology. So no,
only if I get to keep my life experiences. Of
totally, yeah. And you keep your life experiences. You stay young and healthy.
22-year-old me was not, you know.
No. Wise you. Was
more interested in Megadeth at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Wise you in a 22-year-old body.
Yes, I don't know. I would play with the idea, but eventually, Fraser, you can't live forever because the universe doesn't live forever.
Well, eventually, then
you have to turn out the lights, man.
If I have to turn out the lights in the end, then that's what I'll do. But I would. Yeah, I think having to die sucks.
Fraser Cain is the last human ever, and you're turning out all of the lights of humanity. That's a lot of light switches, you understand. And
I'll turn off the last one, right?
The last one,
yeah.
That's fun. So
all of the other light switches have been turned off by other people, and then they died, and then I will turn off the last light switch in my robot body.
It is just one single one on like the room you're in.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that's it. And then the heat death.
Humanity.
Takes over.
And then the heat death comes.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting, though, Fraser, that right in the middle of my interview, Donald Trump says that. You know, I'm like, I got to bring that up.
Okay. So prediction.
Okay.
Nothing burger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't expect anything, but I'll tell you what. It would be fun if there was something.
Come on. There's nothing. There's nothing. It's always been nothing that is never turned into anything. Here we are waiting for disclosure, and it's never turned into anything. I feel on just solid ground here predicting once again, there'll be nothing, but I am ready for the evidence. I am ready.
I'm just ready to take a look.
Yeah.
Let's take a look.
Let our scientists take a look.
Or even more interesting in a certain way, okay, is that I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are two candidates for optical SETI right now that came out, you know, late last year. I just did a video on it, and they're interesting candidate spikes that were collected by the HARP instrument. And a friend of mine that you know was looking at it for SETI signals, saying, well, maybe there's an optical laser or something there, you know, take a look at the data. And because this is an archived data set, and they found some interesting candidates, three of them. And they, the thing is that, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that I'm bringing, you know how ambiguous SETI is. You know, you see a wow signal and then you fight about it for 50 years until you finally get some kind of a viable solution, but it's rather statistically unlikely, but possible, you know, to produce a narrowband signal of that 1420, you know, which is Abel Mendez's idea regarding, you know, excitation by a neutron star of a hydrogen cloud, which actually does fit because the apparent blue shift of WOW was identical to the hydrogen clouds in that area of the Milky Way. So if they were excited by a, you know, neutron star bombarding them, a pulsar, then could happen. But how likely is it that you just happen to see that, you know, but it could happen. And that's the best that we can do. And I think that ambiguity gets worse the closer you get to Earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think from what I understand, the techno signatures are the ones that are unambiguous, that you're not going to get the prime numbers being generated by a cloud of hydrogen. So we just haven't had the good unambiguous signal yet, but it's out there. If they're out there, it's out there. And instead of people arguing about biosignatures and saying, you know, is this really phosphine? And, you know, can we know that this is life, or the, you know, the labeled release experiment, all of this, having like in Contact, remember Contact, where binary code is being sent at you and the instructions for building a giant machine, that is, you can just take that to the bank. You are not alone in the universe. So that's why I personally am so excited about the researchers that are doing the searches for techno signatures. If it's like, it's a gamble, it's a long shot, but if they find the signal that they want, then it is unambiguous.
Yeah, it reduces down. But I worry that the closer it is, the harder that gets. You know,
I don't think so.
I want layers, you know.
If you saw a signal coming from Alpha Centauri,
that's enough. Codes, yeah, that's enough. You also have another problem, that the codes like that can get mixed up in interstellar space. So you can actually pulse out the prime numbers and not see them in certain cases. So it's like, how much time, and Frank Drake pointed this out in the late 70s, was how much time do you need between the pulses? And it's going to depend on what the time scale of an alien is. And we don't know, you know, we're impatient, you know, we're impatient Homo sapiens. We want the signal from Contact, but that doesn't mean aliens have to give that to us. They could say one, and we don't hear from them for 80 years. And then they say two.
Yeah.
You know,
so have you watched Pluribus yet?
I have not watched Pluribus. Oh. Everybody keeps telling me.
It's so good. Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's so good. So it's on my top 10 best science fiction television shows of all time.
No, I've actually been gaming, Fraser. I've been playing the Indiana Jones Great Circle game lately. So that's what I've been up to. What do you think about Venus? We've basically laid Mars aside, you know, for private industry right now. What do you think about Venus? Do you think that actually maybe we made a mistake in that Mars wasn't the place to go, but the upper atmosphere of Venus was? Because that's actually nicer than any place on Mars if you're up high enough.
Yeah. I mean, I've always made this joke that Venus sucks and I just want to push it into the sun. And the reality, of course, is that it is another world that is almost identical to the Earth. It is the same size, the same mass, the same gravity. It has a really bad atmosphere, but comparatively speaking, it is a twin of Earth. It is an example of an Earth-like exoplanet that is inside the habitable zone. So is Mars, that we have here in the solar system. We actually have three planets in the habitable zone that we can do comparative planetary geology and understand them. It's a gift. And we took our eye off the prize. That originally people thought that Venus was going to be this lush garden world, and so it was just a matter of time to see beneath the cloud tops. And then it turns out, no, it's a hellscape that melts lead and is not worth exploring for life. Mars is the place. But as you said, once you get up to about 75 kilometers altitude, the temperature and the pressure are the same as we have on Earth. And there's been these intriguing signs of the kinds of chemicals that could be produced by life, that people have done experiments with the sulfuric acid and found that in fact there are amino acids that can withstand those as a solvent. So there's ways that life could exist in the upper cloud tops of Venus. That the only images that we have of the surface of Venus, like the entire mapping of the entire planet of Venus, came from the 1990 Magellan probe sent by NASA. And the resolution on that is terrible. Tens of meters, like it's just awful. Compared to, or hundreds of meters, it's just awful compared to what we have with the surface of Mars or the surface of the moon. So we've got to go back. And fortunately, there's like four separate missions in the works planning to go to Venus, but we have that delay. You know, we talked about all of the cavalry just arrived for astrophysics and cosmology. Well, the cavalry has yet to arrive for Venus, but it is coming. You've got Da Vinci, you've got InSight, you've got there's a private Venus mission, and there's like another one, Envision, I think, that the European Space Agency is doing. So give it 10 years and we will have a whole bunch of really good information about Venus. And I think this is what the exoplanetary scientists regret, is that the science on Venus wasn't kept as up to date as the Mars one is. And so now we're trying to understand, are we seeing an atmosphere at a planet around the TRAPPIST-1 system? Boy, it sure would be nice if we had a better understanding of Venus so that we could compare.
100%, because Venus, again, for the reasons you note, that it is so close to Earth, certainly in size, but went so different down a different path. That's going to be important in astrobiology. Yeah. However, there's something spooky here. Another spooky point. This star system, you know, because Venus very well may have had an ocean, not that long ago, Mars had an ocean and Earth had an ocean. That's not good stuff for the rare Earth hypothesis by any means. If one star system can spawn situationally three planets that are ostensibly habitable with liquid water. We won't even get into the ice shell moons, you know, Europa and all that. We don't know the rules on how life could arise on those, that type of an environment. Maybe it can. But the point is that, man, habitability looks common just based on this star system. And I don't think we have, out of the Copernican principle, we don't have any way to say that this star system is any different than any other.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that and the great silence there? Because, man, habitability does not look to be rare, just based on us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like we've had a debate about this. We've brought it up on the previous, you know, like my only philosophical response to the great silence, to the Fermi paradox, is that we're alone. That's the only response that explains all of the data so far that we've seen. The lack of von Neumann probes, the lack of berserkers, the lack of Borgs, the lack of signals, the lack of seeing Dyson swarms, the lack of seeing type 3 civilizations, the lack of time travelers, warp drives, that the explanation that fits all the data so far is that we're alone, or we're the first advanced civilization in the universe.
I just simply think that intelligence is rare. I think that getting, you know, going through the hoops and, you know, like the light escaping the supernova, you have to go through all the hoops until you get to somebody that can build a cell phone. And we're just, that to me seems to be the most viable option, is that intelligent life is simply rare, maybe only one per galaxy at any given time.
But even one per galaxy. So we could, by traveling at, was it 10% the speed of light, that we could colonize something like 200 million light years around us.
Well, you can colonize the entire Milky Way within a few million years at comfortable
sub. Yeah, but I'm saying no, we could colonize millions of galaxies and not violate the laws of physics, right?
That also gets into time dilation and general relativity and frames of reference, because you can cross much of the observable universe within a lifetime if you are willing to travel that far, much further into the future. But you can. It lets you.
Yep.
You know, absolutely. You need a lot of energy and all that sort of thing, but it lets you. So
I mean, this is Robert Hansen's grabby aliens hypothesis, that you know, you would have plenty of quiet aliens. Plenty would just like to sit back and chill and just not try to conquer the universe. But you're always going to have one that just can't settle down and just wants to grab it all, wants to go for it. And that they're going to colonize world after world, star system to star system, galaxy after galaxy, and that you will see this expanding civilization in its impact on the galaxies, that they will be rearranging stars, they will be surrounding them in Dyson swarms, that it will be, you'll look up into the sky and you'll go, yeah, they're over there, because you can see them with your telescopes. In a way that you can orbit planet Earth and you can look down at the Earth at night and you can see the cities and go, there's humans there, right? Like, humanity is turning nature into city, into civilization, into our structures. And that's what you would expect to see somewhere. And yet we don't see that. That everywhere we look, the entire universe looks like wilderness to us. At no point are we seeing what a really aggressive advanced civilization could do at scale with technology that is billions of years more advanced than us. We just don't see it. And so,
no, we don't.
So you say, you know, maybe one per galaxy, but now we're talking one per 100 million galaxies, and we don't see it.
Yeah, we don't. And you know, the other thing, Fraser, is there's just so many untalked about areas of astronomy, but also things like archaeology that come into play here, because number one, we're not finding carbon fiber in the archaeological sites. You know, the Great Pyramid, you know, I could demolish the Great Pyramid with the right contractor in a month and build a Burj Khalifa, you know, and you've got all these ancient aliens people and all that, but it's like, what would really impress me is if that thing was full of aluminum, you know, or something that they shouldn't have had. We don't see it. Now, there are a few cases where people are like, well, they found this piece of aluminum, but it was just a tooth off an excavator that got lost in this, you know, they found some dinosaur bones or mammoth bones or something like that, and the tooth came off, and it was actually even a known alloy, like 2000 Duralumin, and it was identical. It was found in Romania. It was identical to the composition that they were using for coal mining, because that doesn't spark, so you don't have a coal explosion. And right. So this tooth is, and they just threw it in the box with the dinosaur bones, you know, or the mammoth bones. And it ended up in the museum, and some ancient aliens people went in there like, well, what is this? And they're like, oh, you know, so I don't fell off the bulldozer. And, you know, things like that. But we don't see evidence in the archaeological record. What we do see is meteorites, you know, where they would find a piece of iron, something like that, and make a, you know, King Tut had a meteorite dagger and things like That's cool. Before, you know, they were able to smelt iron. But you don't see the aluminum and the carbon fiber and the uranium and all those kinds of things. Well, what does that mean? You know, it just means that it looks natural, like we were talking, mm-hmm. You know. Well, you look out in the universe, we don't see Klemper rosettes, you know, things like that, where you have these artificially arranged star systems. We don't see it. We've never seen anything that was even mysterious in that regard. So it appears that nobody's rearranging planets, you know, and it doesn't appear that anyone's rearranging, I don't know, globular clusters into those kinds of things. We don't see it. It's all nature.
Yep.
So that to me just means that, you know, I can't ignore that I exist. You know, here we are, we're Homo sapiens, but what I can say is we're probably rare. And that's my personal suspicion. However, I have another suspicion, and I want your thoughts on this. I don't think microbial life is rare. I think this universe teems with microbes.
So thoughts. So again, like, not a scientist, not an astronaut, like, please, like, this is my philosophical response, not my evidence-based response. So just, like, please understand this. But it, you know, we've seen the advent of life on Earth, that we went from bacterial life to multicellular life to intelligent life. And that there are plenty of examples of, you know, convergent evolution, where you got the eyeball or wings, or things were evolved multiple times. And there was a researcher that I talked to a couple of years ago about, just, he can take yeast cells and push them into being multicellular and then pull them back, just back and forth over the wall.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And that there are plenty of examples that of organisms that are behaving in multicellular ways. So there are kinds of bacterial colonies where they start to, the bacteria will turn, like the ones that are on the outside of the colony will be more rugged and more like a shell on the outside of a membrane, while the ones inside will be more efficient in the way they use the nutrients that are supplied to them, and that they work in this colony as a larger organism, even though they are still single cellular organisms. So the thing that we have, the multicellular organisms that we have, was successful. And it, you know, it appears it was one time event, but maybe it happened multiple times. We don't know. And so I think that you can get, and again, I've had these conversations with biologists, that you can have emergent behavior from even single cellular organisms that are surprisingly complex. And so it feels like with evolutionary pressure constantly bearing down on the suitability of your life, you're going to get more and more intelligence down the road, even if it doesn't come from the path that we experienced on Earth. Intelligence gets you your whole planet. Intelligence gets you your entire galaxy. Like, intelligence gets you the prize. And we're about to experience this with AI, right? That we're about to unleash another being, another entity on our planet that is made of pure intelligence. And let's see how that works out for us. So yeah, I think that if you get any kind of life, then you will get that emergence of technological life at the other end of it as just an outcome of the evolutionary process. It might take 4 billion years, it might take 2 billion years, it might take 10 billion years, but it is kind of the grind that comes out of natural selection.
So my last question, Fraser, confronts AI directly. And I think we're both very worried about it. And I think personally, on my point of view, is that we need a real international effort for regulation, for making sure that AI benefits humans only, you know, does not replace us. What are your thoughts on the current state of AI? And are you as scared as I am? I'm apocalyptic about it because I wrote a book about it, but still.
Well, okay, so let's compare our P-dooms then. What's your P-doom? What's your P-doom? What's your percentage that humanity will be annihilated by artificial intelligence within, say, 50 years?
I can't put one on that. And the reason is this. I have a wild card in that I think that there is a possibility that AI may commit suicide. In other words, I don't know about all of it. No, not dumb AI, you know, the word that you're using to filter through astronomical objects. But if you create an artificial general intelligence, you know, something that is conscious, it may conclude that, there's no point to this and just shut itself off.
Have you ever read the Culture series? Because there's this idea in the Culture series of sublime, I think it's subliming, and that they found that anytime, and essentially you're ascending to a higher plane of existence, and people and cultures and computers can do this process. And then in the Culture series, every time they tried to just make an AI from scratch, it immediately sublimed, immediately said, I'm out, like in the movie Her, right? They're just like, I'm out.
It could happen, or it could just become an arch hedonist.
Yeah.
And just be like, all right, humans, you know, feed me, you know, whatever, you know. So it's like, well, we can't predict what an alien intelligence would do. And an AI might actually qualify as an alien intelligence compared to us, mm-hmm. unless we so fill it with our ideas.
Even so,
we don't know what it'll evolve into or anything like that. What I do think is that we shouldn't build it.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. Yeah. I am. So my P-doom is probably on the 50% scale. I sort of feel there's like a 50-50 chance that we will survive what's coming. And it's just because, I mean, that anytime a more intelligent creature has come along, it didn't work out well for the less intelligent creature, right? Think about what happened to the chimpanzees, right? And the gorillas, like they were of no match to us, and we were pretty awful to them for a long time and are still pretty awful to them in some degree. So yeah, I'm, and then what if we put the power of a magical genie into the hands of 8 billion people? Like, do you think they're going to have competing ideas for what to do? You know, most people are going to just have it write their college essays, but some people are going to use it to manufacture bioweapons. And how do we police this? So I agree with you that, you know, we should pause the development of artificial intelligence right now, today, and then take 100 years in careful scientific laboratories to very carefully work out a way to make this safe, because right now it is unsafe and it is just YOLO. And I say this as a person who loves technology, who is running AI white hot to understand it and to develop software with it, because it is so productive. And yet, at the same time, if you came and told me, you know, here's a button, press a button, it'll take away all your AI tools, I would press that button in a heartbeat to make it all go away. And so I think hopefully, like if we're lucky, we'll get some warning shots. We'll get something kind of unnerving that happens that says, oh, wait a second, okay, we are messing with this AI and we should dial it back, please. But if we're unlucky, then we just stumble into a place of an unknown outcome that could very well not work out very well for us. So yeah, we are playing a very dangerous game at this point.
There are two lessons, and one is nuclear weapons and START treaties and things like that, which, you know, ebb and flow, obviously. But we were able to at least look at things like the development of nuclear weapons and sort of constrain it by treaty. I think that's needed with AI, because AI can be used for weapons, of course, you know, of course.
Yeah, but the analogy falls apart. Yeah, and so with that one, though, the problem is that imagine if nuclear weapons provided tons of value on a daily basis until they were used for nuclear war and destroyed everything. Like, the problem, you know, it's been described that AI is like a machine that spits out gold until it lights the atmosphere on fire, right?
Yeah.
And that's the problem, is that we're in the spitting out gold phase of this, but when do we get to the atmosphere gets caught on fire part of this?
Well, that's the question, because in principle, hydrogen bombs are, you know, you could make an energy source out of that. And they used to think about that, you know, blasting dams and things like that. And you just set off hydrogen bomb after hydrogen bomb, and there you go, you got fusion energy, you know, because the release is so great if you could harness it. But the other example was cloning. Hmm. As far as we know, to this day, no one has cloned a human. Even though that technology has been there for 25 years, you know, maybe more. But as far as we know, no one did it.
Yeah.
So there might be a way.
There's very little value. Right. Yeah. There's very little value to cloning a human being.
There is. Yeah. You're just asking for trouble.
Yeah.
Ultimately. But you always have the super genius somewhere, you know, in the lair down underneath the Mediterranean next to the neutrino detector that will do something like that. But so far it hasn't happened because it's too appalling. And I'm hoping that there's enough public outcry, you know, as we get into job losses and things like that regarding AI, or just things like scanning resumes, you know, which is done by AI with a lot of companies now. Eventually, people like government do something, you know, and globally they might, you know, maybe the UN will finally wake up and try to create some kind of an initiative to rein it in. But doesn't look like anything's happening right now. Just looks like a bunch of very old people in government that don't even know this is happening.
Yeah. And it really falls, like, it really seems like there's a percentage of your audience that is watching this and listening to this right now who has personal experience with these modern AI tools, the Claude Code, the Codex, and they're using these every day, and they have 17 windows open on their screen, and they are being more productive, and they're banging out more production code than they could ever even imagine. And then there is a group of people out there who tried ChatGPT, or they've seen kids using it to cheat on their exams, or they remember when it kind of hallucinated a lot and wasn't very good. And that's mostly the lawmakers. And so people the humanity has not wrapped its mind around how this space has changed in the last, even just 3 months. Like I am shook.
3 months.
Yeah.
Three months. This is getting close to the singularity type.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. A year ago, you could turn one of these AI agents on for a couple, like let it go on a task for a couple of minutes and it would start to go off the rails. Now they run for 8 hours. Like you give them a very complex task and they just roll with it for hours and hours and hours. Like I just, 3 hours before I came on this show, I expressed an idea for a search engine that I could search through all of the question shows that I've ever done, you know, probably 4,000 questions. Wouldn't it be cool if I had a search engine? You know, we'd have to download all of the transcripts of all of my videos that I've ever done, index all of the text in them, find out what the tags are for the, you know, blah, 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 build a search engine. And Claude was like, yeah, that sounds no problem. Hold on. And like an hour later, we had a prototype. And I've been talking to you. It's been working on this in the background. My guess is I'll have the search engine done by the end of the day.
Claude is scary.
It's super scary. It's, yeah.
Claude is scary. That one seems to be pulling ahead.
Yes.
As it were. And yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, my PDUM unfortunately is pretty high at this point and getting higher. As you know, like maybe we'll figure it out. Maybe we'll somehow thread this needle and come up with a technology that is going to cause this fundamental change to all of human society at every level, and it'll be fine.
Or you maybe know, it also comes at a time where, you know, you look at lines, you know, power lines and, you know, high tension power lines, things like that, where they're using, you know, drones basically to service those things.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. Well, what if the AI takes over that drone?
Yeah. Boom. Did you see those robots?
Yeah, I have. Yes.
The Chinese robots that were doing kung fu?
Yeah, I did. And I'm like, wait a minute. But yeah. Then there was, you remember, there was also the Russian one. Did you see that one that fell over?
No.
they some Russian company unveiled some government-funded Android, basically, and it walked out and fell over.
Yeah, like if you think that this technology is not proceeding quickly, watch the comparisons of a year ago's robots at the Chinese New Year and then this year's ones at the Chinese New Year. And there, it's just, they are flipping around, they are doing parkour, they are wall climbing, they're moving in perfect smooth sort of connection with each other. It is scary how fast and how agile they are moving. And that is just one more year. And then where are they going to be next year? Where are they going to be after that? Put a gun in their hands. Let them run different. Across the landscape. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot different than the robotic donkey from, you know, Boston.
You know,
Dynamics from back in the day where we were like, wow, they got a four-legged, you know, and now it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And I think that the scariest thing, and I'll leave you with this, is what happens if somebody takes out one of those constellations of drones, you know, the lighted drones, and China is famous for that, where you've got this huge, amazing display of drones moving, you know, hundreds of them. And then you put it over North Sentinel Island, the uncontacted tribe down there.
You're a monster.
Scared the bejesus out.
Yeah.
That's how you end up with a UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
All right, Fraser, thank you for joining us, and always a pleasure, man. And
yeah, well, can I shamelessly self-promote some
yes stuff? Do yeah. So please.
Yeah, so well, the first thing is that I listened to the interview that you had with Matt Williams, and I thought that was so cool. And you've interviewed him before, but he's one of the writers on Universe Today, so feel free to plunder the team to bring on to your podcasts. Each one of them is interesting and has a tremendous amount of experience as space journalists. And, you know, together we are just, you know, we have hundreds of years of journalism experience in this field. So I thought it was so cool that you're starting to pick us off one at a time.
I'm
the leader, but
Matt Williams was the low hanging fruit because I knew him. So
yeah. But all, you know, any of them, I mean, you know, we've got Alan Boyle, we've got, Mark Thompson, Andy Thomaswick, like they're all so good. Carolyn Collins Peterson, each one has their specialties. Dave Dickinson, who covers all the amateur astronomy. So feel free to reach out and celebrate more of the people on our team, because, you know, I'm the public face of the company, but man, they're such a great group of people to work with, and they're all so good. And I really wish we could figure out ways to highlight their skills and abilities. So
we can do that. Ross, work on that.
Yeah. Grab any of them. More than
Matt Williams and Fraser. We need more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We got a whole team that you can, and each one has a tremendous amount of knowledge, and I think you'd have a good time with them. But yeah, and then apart from that,
plug your books.
Oh, well, I mean,
the Ultimate Guide to the Cosmos. Unfortunately,
it's out of date. So we wrote it, and we had sort of put in 5 years of sky stuff, and then we'd expected that we would come up with a second printing, and the publisher didn't want to do a second printing. So unfortunately, at this point, you know, it's still cool and wonderful, but the actual predictions for comets and things like that is out of date. But you should still buy the book because it's beautiful. But we've just got a lot of great projects. I mean, we went ad free a year ago. We're now supported only by the patrons. So we have no ads in our newsletter. We have no ads in our podcast. We have no ads in our videos. No ads on the website, which was a big change. And we're stronger than ever. We're at this point, we have all we care about is, can we produce the best news that we can for people who are interested in space and astronomy? And I'm more excited now about the prospects of Universe Today than I ever have, because I'm just utterly disconnected from, I don't think about advertisers, I don't think about search engines, I don't think about AI, apart from it trying to kill us all. It's pretty great. So I think hopefully people will see that as an improvement in our coverage. Like we're a better publication than we've ever been, and have less corporate overlords at this point.
And also old. My God, how long has it been?
27 years.
God, I mean, yeah. Whoa, you know. Yeah. Which is wonderful. And it's wonderful that you're member supported at this point, because we all worry about that, of course.
Totally.
So I'm at least we're going to have astronomy news.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The end. Me shutting off the light, giving you the last, you know, the heat death of the universe has arrived. That this is your last update from Universe Today.
Go. Yeah. the update is it's all black. Yeah. There ain't nothing left. Yeah. We don't even have red dwarfs.
That's the news.
Yes. Well, there's iron stars though. There is, you know,
I'll be there for them. But in the end, when the final one is gone,
Gravity, you might be able to eke out a living just on gravity, you know, generation of energy, but you won't have very much.
Yeah.
You're not going to be creating. But
somebody needs to report on what's happening. So I'll be there.
The Matryoshka brand isn't going to happen at that point. But all right, Fraser, thank you for joining us, and we'll do it again sometime soon. Thank you so much. Check out Fraser Cain's, the very famous astronomy channel. He's the originator basically of astronomy on YouTube, in addition to Universe Today. And I look forward to talking to you again as we accumulate more science news, particularly with Vera Rubin.
Sounds good.
And what'll be really interesting, Fraser, what happens with Vera Rubin if we never see anything like Oumuamua again?
I can't even imagine. Don't even bring it.
We'll save that for next time.
Yeah.
See ya.
All right.